and recording patrons. Hello, patrons. We're all here.
Hey, patrons. So I have a question for Tom, which some patrons might find interesting as well.
Two-ply. Oh, wait. Is that not your question?
No. No. Two-ply is for barbaric people.
That's me.
You need at least four.
Jesus, that's like a quilt.
One-ply.
Oh, my God. One-ply.
That's like North Korean.
Ugh. No, that, yeah, that cannot even be. It's almost as bad as the tooth. we weren't recording when we were talking.
No. I think anyway, people probably get it if they've ever been to a dentist.
Some people. If you get it, why talking about teeth is a difficult topic for me, then you've been following the show for long enough. No, my question is about mesh Wi-Fi networks.
Oh, uh-huh.
So I know you have one. Mm-hmm. I know there are, I think, a couple of brands, and I think Google is doing one now.
They are, yep.
Can you explain to me in a few minutes what's good and bad about them and each brand, and are they desirable already?
Yeah, I can tell you less about the differences between the brands because I only have direct experience with Eero. And I know there's some differences in radio strength. That I would look at like the wire cutter to find out like, okay, what actually is the difference between like the Linksys has them now and Netgear has some now. And
oh, so there's a ton. Like,
yeah, some... I would definitely go to the wire cutter and look at what they say. On the principle of mesh networks, though, I can say that, and from what I've read, this bears out across the brands, positioning is important. And that's one of the differences between the brands. Like Eero has a system that it says we'll help you figure out the best position and places.
Okay.
But you do need line of sight for optimal performance. Now, I don't have line of sight. I have my modem in my garage, so there's no way that, you know, the fiber ONT is in the garage. There's no way.
Wait a second. Line of sight?
For optimal performance, right? So they're like, if you can put it in view of the other, you'll get the best connection. That said, it still does go through walls and stuff, so you don't have to have it. So what I did is I have the Eero one base unit right next to my ONT in the garage going straight up, because I have two floors, right? Going straight up to another one in the kitchen. So there's a minimal amount. There's just the floor between them. And then I kept that one in line of sight of the one in the living room. The one in the office really can't do that. So there's a little bit of a skill in the placement of them.
But so they don't. I thought the way it worked was they would use the, how do you call it, like power line.
Eero's just use Wi-Fi. I think there may be some that do power line extension, but those are different. Those aren't mesh.
So that's what I have. I currently have some that do power line. But then the problem is they create different networks, and then you need to connect to one or the other.
No, these are not power line, but they are all one network. Signal.
They receive the Wi-Fi signal and amplify it again.
They mesh it. So basically, they either pass it along, right?
But how do you transmit? No, that's the question. How do you transmit it from one base to the other?
Well, you don't have to know. It just does it. But it has got networking technology where it's switching. It's basically saying, we think, like, two of the base stations will receive the same laptop signal, right? And it will decide, it's got an algorithm that says, this is the strongest one, so we're going to send and receive from this station, and we also have an algorithm that decides what the shortest route to the base station by the modem is.
But how does that station get the signal? That's my question.
So you have one mesh network connected to your modem, one station connected to your modem, and that it transmits to the other ones.
Okay, so it's kind of like it's getting the Wi-Fi. All of them are getting different.
At its simplest, to understand it, it's just a form of wireless ad hoc connection.
Oh, okay.
Not exactly. Not exactly, though, because ad hoc is its own thing that has big problems that these don't. These will talk to each other not on Wi-Fi.
So they have a dedicated network.
They have their own. Some of them do, some of them don't. But I think that if I have it right, the Eero's, you know, communicate directly with each other so that they don't cause interference with the Wi-Fi signal in general.
Go ahead, Rob.
I mean, just from my experience of using building old mesh networks before, like the Eero's and stuff came online, all those would essentially kind of work in kind of like a like its own virtual network. So you could connect to any of the units, and
then it would.
But you don't have with these, you don't have to think about that. It's got its own backhaul going on,
and that's
you
what
see Eero one SSID. You connect to that, and it's going to decide which one of these stations it's connecting you behind the scenes.
The reason I'm asking about the way each base gets its network, gets its connection, is that my issue with this is not just that I want one network to connect to, one SSID, but also that in the country house here, we have, it's a large house, and some portions of it don't get good reception. You know, there's like chimneys and these kind of things that block the Wi-Fi network. So if the bases, the different bases get the signal from wireless signals anyway, and that signal doesn't go through, it's not really going to be useful for me.
I don't know what your layout is, but my guess is you can probably find a way around it. Like there's not a chimney that stops all signals from ever getting into the room, right? It's just taking that weak signal and degrading it. So if you might need a few of these, right? You might need four or five of them, but you should be able to figure out a path. And there's setup software to help you figure that out to say like, okay, I'm going to put one, like for instance, the way I do it, I've got one in the garage. I've got one on the other end of the first floor in a power outlet. I've got one in the kitchen above the garage. I've got one in the office, and I've got one in the bedroom and one in the living room.
And that way,
anything that would block any of those signals, there's another route for it to take.
How much do they cost?
I usually get like a 3-pack for $300, that kind of, it ranges.
So if you want five, you're going to be looking at $500.
Well, and what I did was I actually bought, because what Eero came out with is, it's three for 300 roughly for the base stations, but you only need one base station. And they now sell cheaper wall plug units that will work, but they don't have an Ethernet port or a USB port. And they don't cost as much. And they also, you know, they just plug right into the wall. So the placement is not as variable. But I have three base stations and two wall plugs because there's a couple places where I'm like, I just need it to plug into the wall. I don't need the extra stuff. But they are pricey. I mean, that's the thing.
Right. The base station you connect, does it become the router, or do you connect it to your router via, you know, Ethernet, and then you use that as your...
I mean, you could do it either way. You could go Ethernet out of your modem straight into the Eero and use that as your router, or you can bridge it from your router if you need to. That's actually what I do, because I want hardwire connections from my actual router into this machine for streaming.
Right.
And then I come out of the router to the Eero on a separate network.
Yeah, that's another question, because our fiber connection here uses a router type that I don't really know. It's almost like almost OEM type thing.
Yeah. You could just go out of that into the Eero or whatever.
I guess, but I don't know. I've been looking at the, you know, firmware and trying to see if I can put it in bridge mode, and I can't find it. How to set it to bridge.
It might work anyway.
Yeah, a little bit. But then aren't you going to have NAT issues?
Yeah,
like
you might.
And, yeah. Okay.
So wait.
Yeah, Roger, you may know more about this one.
How many routers do you have, Wi-Fi routers? Just two?
Here there's the one that receives the fiber, like the fiber directly. I can't remember the name of the type of connection, but you plug the fiber inside that router and it acts as the Wi-Fi router for the house.
You could do a range extender. You could buy like a really cheap, like a TP-Link router for like $20-25. And then typically those have included software.
Those create another network.
No. When you do a range extender, you basically turn off the NAT function in that router, and all it does is pick up the signal from the first router and will extend it out.
It can add lag, and they're kind of janky, but they work.
It can add lag. Lag is the biggest issue with that, which is why people like mesh networks, because you don't have the same issue. But it is a pretty straightforward thing to do, and it's not terribly expensive.
Yeah. I'd love to have something cleaner though.
I would look at the Wirecutter's breakdown of stuff, right, and then figure out if it fits your budget.
Yeah. But I guess I already have a pretty good router elsewhere that I could use, if I can bridge it to, maybe that would be an easy first solution.
Yeah, I feel like you would be able to do that.
How can I bridge this thing?
Well, I don't know if you want to bridge it though, because bridging is you're bringing two networks together.
I mean, you can just leave the router attached to the Eero and let the router handle NAT for you.
But if you,
because you're not, if, unless you're going to be plugging in a bunch of Ethernet things to the Eero stuff, it's just a Wi-Fi network.
But if you connect your base router to the Eero, then the Eero is having one IP address from the router and subdivides that
into its own NAT.
Into its own NAT. So you have two NATs, one after the other, don't you?
No, you would want to turn off the NAT on the second one, because one of them will have to issue out the rest of the IPs.
Okay, so the you turn off NAT, which means you only have one IP that goes from the... So the Eero would have the IP of the base router. Is that it?
You could forward the IP from... You could turn off the NAT in the router that you plug the fiber into, and then have it basically be replicated in your Eero, since you're only running one device into it.
I thought that would be bridging. Maybe I misunderstood what bridging was. I thought bridging was making the base router a pass-through that would just, you know...
Just don't have Eero do the NAT, I think is what you're saying. And then you're fine.
I thought you were saying have Eero do the NAT and not the base router.
You can let the router do the NAT.
Yeah, you'd have to know what I was saying is in the Eero, you want to set it to...
And Eero's setup software will take all of this out of your hands. It'll say like, oh, we see you have a router. Great. We're going to set this all up. You have control of changing it if you want, but it has a wizard.
All right. Some research is needed.
If you want the first half of this l'entrée of a conversation, you have to get it from the Patreon version of the show. Now we move on to le plat principal.
You amaze me every Tuesday.
That's because today's lesson was le dessert, le plat principal, l'entrée.
I need the le control.
Le control pour le Roger.
Roger.
Yes, I have a thesaurus.
J'aimerais start the show.
Je suis né prêt.
Pourquoi?
Je suis né prêt. I was born ready, is what I'm saying.
Oh, nay. I thought you were saying nah. Sorry. Yes. No. I thought you were saying I'm not ready. Yes, no, you were born ready, of course, because yes. Nay, not na.
Obviously, clearly.
I need to get that E as an A from Spanish out of my head. All right. It'll happen, though. Es que tu peux? Where am I? Okay. I was about to ask you again in English, but I'm like, why? We already know.
Really?
Here we go. The Daily Tech News Show is powered by you. To find out more, head to dailytechnewsshow.com/support. This is the Daily Tech News for Tuesday, August 15th, 2017. I'm Tom Merritt, along with Patrick Beja. How are you, sir?
I am excellent, as usual. Always excellent.
Ah, that's so good. So nice. That's what the clean country living does for you.
Absolutely. I am actually in the countryside right now, as illustrated by the bookshelf behind me. That's the countryside decor.
Yeah, because Patrick retreats into the country to read and think and... Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Let's go with that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Roger Chang, our producer, is alongside as well. Thank you,
Hello.
Roger. Good to have you along. Let's start with a few tech things you should know. Not just Roger, but everybody. Qualcomm is adding depth sensing and biometric authentication, so things like facial recognition, to its Qualcomm Spectra module program for manufacturers of Android phones. The Spectra system lets manufacturers swap out camera functions during manufacturing, giving them some good options to add in functions to their builds, mostly taking advantage of dual camera sensors.
Excellent. Researchers have published a study showing that using a smiley face in a normal workplace email decreases the perception of competence and undermines information sharing. And reading this, I do a little bit of a facepalm and realize that I've been undermining myself.
Winky face.
Yeah,
man, imagine, exactly. Imagine what the poop emoji does to your formal workplace communication. Just saying. Hey, Blizzard's not getting rid of Battle.net after all. The company announced it has decided to just add the name Blizzard to the Battle.net logo, and when referring to Battle.net in print, they'll always call it Blizzard Battle.net. So, compromise solution.
Yeah, no, but so they announced they were going to get rid of Battle.net, calling it the Blizzard service, but Battle.net was still going to be the technology that would power it all under the what's the expression? Under the radar, behind
yes,
the sheets.
Yes, yes.
Exactly.
Behind the curtain.
Behind the curtain. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, producer Roger. And now they're calling it Blizzard Battle.net. It's a mouthful. I think everyone's going to be calling it Battle.net.
Yeah. Although they're going to leave the launcher, which used to be called the Battle.net launcher, is going to stay the Blizzard launcher. It's just the networking that they're going to keep calling Battle.net. Here's some more top stories. ThreatPost reports a wireless update to LockState's 6000i model of smart locks bricked the devices, leaving them unable to be locked without a key. And some people didn't have keys. They were relying only on the app. Customers were instructed to return the locks for repair or replacement. The update was meant for the 7000i models, not the 6000i models. But they sent it to the wrong model, and it caused the locks to fail to reconnect to the web service. And once they couldn't reconnect, I mean, I don't know that this is what happened, but imagine a firmware update that changes the URL of the web service. And then suddenly, once the firmware is in place, it's like, I'm looking, but I can't find any web service. Approximately 200 Airbnb customers were affected by this due to a partnership between Airbnb and LockState.
That's the nightmare scenario, isn't it? Because you're like, well, you just return it. Wait, it's your lock. You
yeah.
have to, like, I'm guessing they're very well attached to the doors that they're locking. It can't be a fun experience for the people that use it.
And that would be the situation where you wouldn't have a key, right? The owner of the yeah. place that they're renting it on Airbnb might have a key, but they're like, oh, we'll just authorize you in this app. Just download this app and you're fine, right? Until you're not
We're
fine.
Living in the future, and everyone who says the future sucks is validated now.
I mean, I hesitate to get too upset at LockState for this because
course.
They're doing the right thing that a lot of these Internet of Things companies don't do, which is trying to update the firmware on a regular basis.
And that's exactly why it's so bad, because they are doing the right thing. They just made a mistake, and mistakes happen. And in the grand scheme of things, this is a minor inconvenience, you know, overall. But it's still an inconvenience that's going to be visible to a lot of to the people who experience it.
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying it's the nightmare scenario.
And don't forget, like my example of how this might happen isn't what happened, because I see people in the chat room who are like, well, here's what you would do to fix that. I'm sure there's a reason why you can't fix it over the air anymore, and you have to bring it in.
Right. They can't just go in and put on that URL that the thing is actually accessing. It's probably not what happened. U.S. District Judge Edward Chen granted a preliminary injunction Monday, telling LinkedIn it could not block a startup called HiQ Labs from accessing public LinkedIn information. HiQ scrapes public data to feed algorithms that try to predict employee behavior, like quitting a job. LinkedIn will continue to fight the case.
Which side would you like to take on this one? Because I'll take whichever one you don't. I can see it this both ways.
Listen, this is public information. It's not locked behind a login or a paywall or anything. They're using public information, and they are using it for whatever they are using it for. It's still public. Yes, it's. I don't know that LinkedIn even owns that information. They're not doing anything that someone couldn't do with a piece of paper and a pen and looking at those pages.
Yeah, so, and Netflix videos are public, right? YouTube videos are public, so I should be able to just scrape all of them and redistribute them myself, right?
Well, Netflix are behind a paywall. YouTube, I think that might be...
That's why I switched to YouTube, because I realized, Netflix not the best example.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between scraping it and repackaging it and using it for profit somewhere else. And
it's a copyright in those cases. Making the copy is what causes the problem, not just the redistribution.
Okay, fair enough. But they're not using, they're using it for research and transforming the data into something else.
Sure. Maybe there is a fair use that you're describing here, but LinkedIn is not saying this is public domain information. They're actually not even they're not even asserting a copyright. What LinkedIn's doing is saying, hey, this is on our website, and there are terms of use for using our website, and you're violating the terms of use of using our website.
They don't have an account though. They're just
using the website doesn't require an account.
Do you? I guess so. Do you have to abide by the terms of use to read what's printed on that page? Printed, quote unquote?
Yes, you do.
All right, fair enough.
Listen, I told you I could take either side of this, and you made me take the side I agree with less. This is harder for me to keep doing because I am with you that if it's public information, you have to expect that people are going to use that information. Yeah,
I'm not even necessarily on that side. I would, however, give the example of remixing music, you sampling things and remixing it, which is largely authorized if it doesn't go beyond a certain threshold.
Another objection that LinkedIn might raise is, this was an undue burden. This is an unanticipated use of its server load. And if they're letting everyone go scrape them, then they're going to spend all their bandwidth and server load on scrapers rather than people who actually want to use LinkedIn. I think that's probably going to be exaggerating the case, but that is the other argument here.
Yeah, it does hold water. It does hold water. I think another very big argument that they're not going to be talking about is if HiQ can start predicting, do that kind of analysis and start predicting when employees using the service are, going to quit their job or look for another job or these kinds of things, can be very embarrassing for the employees, for the employers. And I think that's the most frightening thing.
I'll take it a step further. I think LinkedIn's got their own version of this that they want to sell to LinkedIn clients. And if some other company is doing it with information they can get in public for free, LinkedIn would like to stop them from doing that. However, Judge Edward Chen says, no, you can't block them from doing this. If you're putting it out on the web, you have to expect people to use it, and you can't put conditions on how they use it unless you're asserting a copyright, which LinkedIn is not doing, even though I used that as an example earlier.
And I will say, before we move on, it's actually probably the most interesting thing about this. If this holds, it has implications for many other services other than LinkedIn, which could be, which could make a lot of web giants not happy at all.
No, this is precedent setting either way. It could change what companies are willing to allow to be made public, even for you, which would be an interesting turn of events. If it were to go the other way And in favor of LinkedIn, it could cause problems for search engines. It could allow newspaper organizations, for instance, to say, aha, just because we publish a story doesn't mean you get to index it, Google. So, you know, there's all kinds of precedents that are going to fall out of this no matter how it ends up. Well, folks, there are two kinds of adaptive bitrate for streaming video in this world. Okay, there's more than that, but for our purposes of this argument, there's two kinds of adaptive bitrate for streaming video in this world. The kind that measures your network speed from your device and picks a resolution for you, and the kind that tries to keep a sufficient buffer ahead of playback. Now, both of these have issues that you're probably very familiar with. The rate-based model doesn't deal with network speed fluctuations. That's when everything gets all pixely and you can't see it anymore. The buffer-based one doesn't handle skipping around in the video very well and occasionally buffers, right? And you get the spinning wheel. An algorithm developed at MIT called Pensieve uses machine learning on a neural network to switch between the two models and add details from the server delivery side, giving you the best of both worlds. System can even be adjusted to prefer buffering or resolution, depending on your preference. In tests, Pensieve delivered 10 to 25% quality of experience improvement with 10 to 30% less buffering. Big thanks to Andy Beach, who helped me understand this one. His point to me was, server side hasn't done anything. Usually server side of video streaming is dumb. It just sends the bits. It's all happened on the client side before. And what's interesting is this is putting some things on the server side.
Feels like kind of a predictive kind of, well, the thing is, it's machine learning, which they put lots of examples, simplifying it a lot. They put a lot of examples in it and out spits the machine, you should do it like this. But we don't really understand necessarily, don't always understand how or why. And I mean, here it doesn't necessarily matter all that much, but the machine figures out, now you're going to be using that kind of adaptive bitrate thing. And now you're going to be using the other one. Why? Doesn't matter. Just do it.
It improves the video stream. And it's basically, I mean, if you want to oversimplify it, you break it down into if something's going to cause buffering, you switch to the rate-based one. If the rate-based one's going to get all pixelated, switch back to the buffering, and knowing the conditions well enough to do it in advance so that the video stays nice and smooth.
Yeah, I'm sure Netflix is going to be all over that, and YouTube as well, probably.
Yeah, or Akamai, those kinds of CDNs, definitely, yeah.
Web hosting company DreamHost has filed an opposition to a warrant requesting IP addresses of everyone who ever accessed a site that organized a protest at the U.S. presidential inauguration last January. The warrant also seeks content of all questions and comment forms filled out by any visitor to the site. The U.S. Department of Justice has filed a motion to compel DreamHost to respond. DreamHost says it has been cooperating on subpoenas for individual records in support of the Department of Justice court case, but claims this most recent warrant was overbroad.
Yeah, so two interesting things about this. One is it's not a case of not getting a warrant and saying, hey, you don't have a warrant, I'm not handing things over. In fact, they were cooperating with subpoenas. It's saying, yeah, you've got a warrant, but we don't believe this warrant is valid because you're asking for everything we have, and you don't need everything we have. That's the classic definition of a fishing expedition.
Yeah, it's very clearly, I mean, it sounds like it's clearly an overreach, overbroad, however you want to call it, which should render this kind of thing invalid if it actually is. Looking at it from without knowing all of the details of all of it, it really does seem like it's overreaching. I mean, asking not just for the information of everyone who has ever visited the site, but on top of that, which already that would seem to be overbroad, but on top of that, getting all the questions and comment forms from anyone who ever did any? There needs to be, I mean, this is more of a judicial question, but there needs to be a reason for why you're asking for these kinds of pieces of information.
The reason is, you know, we're going after a criminal and we know they were on this site. We can show evidence of that, but we don't know what their username was on the site, but we can identify them by their behavior and the things they wrote on the comment forms. But to find that and discover the username, we need to see all the comment forms to search through them.
Right. I think this kind of explanation can sound reasonable, but you can use that to justify any request for any information anywhere.
Well, and this is why we become problematic. This is why we have a judicial system. The judge heard that and said, that sounds reasonable. I'll grant the warrant. That's the way it's supposed to work, because if a warrant does get a little overbroad because of a misunderstanding, the person it's served upon has the right to challenge it. And that's what DreamHost is doing. Nobody is acting illegally here. What's happening is the Department of Justice is going after a court, going after a case and saying, we would like this information, convinced a judge to issue a warrant. And DreamHost gets to say, oh, I think you missed something in that warrant. You don't need all 1.3 million IP addresses of everybody who's ever visited the site. I think we could narrow this down by time, by type of user, by, you know, maybe some geolocation of the IP addresses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Unless you really are going on a fishing expedition, in which case that's not okay.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah. Finally, TechCrunch reports that India's EM3 Agri-Services is letting farmers rent out idle equipment, things like harvesters, tractors, even parts and machinery that you add on to harvesters and tractors. This can help small farmers afford to use equipment they couldn't afford otherwise, or make a farmer not have to take a risky loan that could bankrupt them to just get the equipment they need to make farms. Farms are very small in India. They have a larger number of farmers on small holdings in India, well above the United States. Company does have an app, but because it's dealing with such small farmers, it also operates using the phone, because a lot of these farmers don't have smartphones. So it's Uber for farmers who don't have smartphones. Because it's using technology. It's using technology on their end to matchmake, but not everybody in the system has to have an app or a phone.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. It's one of the more, for us, I guess, more surprising applications of the concept of Uber or Airbnb. Just not only for farm equipment, but also via phone. That's a surprising one.
Yeah, by telephone, not smartphone. Yeah. EM3 says it has worked with 8,000 farms so far and has partnered with the government of the state of Rajasthan, which is one of the big agricultural states, maybe the biggest agricultural state in India. So I love this story because I love stories where we take a system that we think of only for one thing, like ride hailing, and apply it to something else in a way that's really going to help. This is going to make things possible for farmers in India that were not possible.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Folks, if you want to get all the tech headlines each day in about 5 minutes, be sure to subscribe to dailytechheadlines.com. You can also get the Daily Tech Headlines as an Amazon Echo Flash briefing. And you can get it on the Google Home through the Anchor service, which you can also get it on the Anchor app at anchor.fm. And that's a look at our top stories. Now, abide with us for a moment, if you will, and think back to an earlier time before the web, before the dark times, when you here in the United States had to have a CompuServe account or an AOL account, maybe, or something like that.
Prodigy.
And you wanted to chat with somebody, you wanted to shop, you wanted to check stock prices. That's what you had to do, unless you were in France. France in the 80s was a wonderland of information sharing because of something called Minitel. Patrick, you lived, you grew up with Minitel.
Yeah, basically. It's funny. I was convinced that most people knew about the Minitel because it was such a big deal in the tech world and so innovative. And I was doing a show with Alison Sheridan last week. And I think she hadn't heard about the Minitel at all. So I figured maybe your audience would be interested in hearing about it. Basically, what it was a full telecommunications package that you could get from essentially the government. And I think that's a really interesting aspect of it as well. It was completely government, a government initiative via the post and telecommunications monopolistic company. So you would get this all-in-one box, which included the screen, the foldable keyboard, which would fold up to the screen, And the modem included in the box, of course. You would plug it into your power outlet and telephone outlet. I don't know how you call those T-shaped things. Anyway, so the old ones that we had in France. I think they were different for you guys. But anyway, and you would connect it like this, turn it on, and then dial up a service on a price structure. So you would connect to, there were, you know, a number of different numbers. It would be 3611 for the free one, 3612, 3613, and up to 3617, which could go up to, like, I think up to a couple of dollars a minute. It was really expensive at the higher tiers. But the really interesting thing was that it was a type of service that anyone could develop. And, you know, they would need to get not a license, but work with the telecom company to get it on the network. But it's not like AOL or Prodigy or anything like that, because it wasn't all centralized. You would dial into the price number, I guess, and then you would type the name of the service you wanted to access. And you would go to their servers. I don't know exactly how it worked on the back end, but it was anyone could develop a service for this thing.
So it was very internet-like.
Yeah, exactly.
Without being part of the internet.
It was absolutely not part of the internet. It was completely closed. Well, I mean, closed within its own system. But I'm not sure how well it could have worked on the internet. It was so far before the you know, the large public had access to the internet. It started, I would say, 85, 86. It was like widespread.
Yeah.
A lot of people had it was
launched as a test in Brittany in 1978 and then went France-wide in 1982. But yeah, you're right. It wasn't like in 1982, suddenly everybody had it. But the machines were free. I think that was one of the keys to this taking off, because they tried it in Ireland later. And in Ireland, it didn't catch on because you had to buy the thing.
Yeah, they were free. I mean, you would pay for it 10 times over through the different services you could use, obviously. But it was also very cleverly designed. I think the design part of it, I touched on it just now, but it was really an all-in-one box. And it was the size of a small box. So it wouldn't take up, you wouldn't even really need a desk. You would put it by the telephone. And most people were thinking about it as something you would use for a couple of minutes to get the information you needed. Obviously, as time went on, the users developed in different ways. But it was one small box, the foldable keyboard. I don't know if I'm explaining it right, but basically it was a solid keyboard. Like, the keys were solid plastic, very chunky, and you would fold it up to the screen so that it would basically close the box. And so that made it super easy to disseminate. You would just go get it as you would go get a telephone. It was just as easy to use, almost as easy to use.
Well, and the idea originated with a 1978 report to President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. You just say it.
Almost. Valéry Giscard d'Estaing.
Titled "The Computerization of Society," government researchers Simon Nora and Alain Manck argued that the solution to France's telecom woes lay in telematics, and so they decided to replace the phone book. You wouldn't get the white pages anymore. You'd get this thing instead, which saved on printing costs, and then you would look up the numbers in this pretty good search engine, as I understand it. But it took off from there. You could do train tickets. You could do stock prices. You could do mail. You could do chat. You could do shopping. This sounds like the internet to me. But it's not the internet. It's its own internet.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the, you mentioned it, one of the interesting thing is that it was really top down. As some of the, you know, political differences we often talk about between France, Europe, and the US and other countries, this was really a government-led operation, which was very successful. I'm not saying this to, you know, make it sound like, oh, it was the government. I quite the opposite. It was very successful in its time. And yeah, you could do the phone book thing was the very obvious first use, and that was free. Then you had different messaging systems. Then you had some kind of different kinds of shopping. But the one that really took off was chatting. Chatting became incredibly popular, incredibly expensive. Kids like me, because remember, you would have the different price structures, but most of them, well, all of them, you would pay per minute. So it was more or less expensive, even if it's, you know, 10 cents per minute, when you're spending 2, 3, 4, 5 hours, and it wasn't just 10 cents, by the way, it was a lot more usually. If you had access to the cheaper access to the thing with a password and everything, you would pay less, but usually you would pay more. And if you do that 5 hours a day, as some kids might have been known to do, the phone bill racks up. And the chat was awesome, and I think that was the most internet-like experience of all of it, because it was gathering communities with similar interests from all over the country that you wouldn't necessarily have been able to interact with physically because you were too far away, or maybe you didn't have people who enjoyed the same kind of things as you did in your vicinity, and you would gather in those chat rooms and talk about stuff.
There were other kinds of chat rooms too, weren't there?
Well, obviously, when you're talking about a new kind of communications medium, you're going to have porn that is going to be quite popular.
It's not a kind of internet if you don't have that.
If you don't have porn. There were, I mean, I think most people will still remember the 3615 ULA service, which was 3615 ULA. For some reason, the name Ulla was evocative of some kind of eroticized something, and everyone knew it. And I don't think I went on that one. I don't honestly don't remember that I used porn so much. I was so geeky that I would go to, you know, anime websites and not websites, but chat rooms and stuff like that. But yeah, it was super successful, and it made a lot of money. And the Minitel continued. There wasn't so much piracy, of course, because, you know, it was so slow.
You couldn't really copy files, yeah.
Exactly. It was like, it would take, I would say, maybe 3 seconds to display one page, and the screen was tiny, and it was just, you know, text.
Well, one rating I read was a downlink of 1,200 bits per second. Not kilobits, not megabits. Bits per second. Yeah.
And remember, this was the early 80s when it started. So obviously it's not going to be very fast. But it kept going, and it was so successful and so monetarily successful for some of those services. There were a number of models that came out afterwards, one that had color, which was amazing. And it kept going until I think it shut down in like 2012.
June 30th, 2012. Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. It's insane. And obviously it wasn't very used by then. You always have some people who don't want to get on with the new thing, but I think it was used until regularly by a significant amount of people, probably until the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah. I think I read that in 2009, they first discussed shutting it down, and they put it off because they got enough people who were still using it. And then I think it dwindled enough by 2012, some less than a million at that point. So they decided to get rid of it.
Yeah. I think by then it's the kind of uses that until if you never take it away, they're never going to go away, right?
Well, but and a lot of the uses were through the web. There was a web interface in the later days, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, they, and I really want to, you know, I really want to emphasize how cool and ahead of its time this thing was, because a lot of people compare it to, you know, AOL and this and that. I think AOL, it was a little bit later. Wasn't it?
Yeah, much later than 1978, for sure. Right. Yeah. CompuServe is roughly equivalent to it, I think.
Exactly. I think, you know, BBS is CompuServe, that kind of thing. Yeah. But those, I'm pretty sure, were very geeky. You know, you had to know your stuff to go on CompuServe and to go to BBSs. That was used by a large portion of the population. I think that was...
I think this is really interesting because that 1978 report was in response to France lagging behind in technology. And the government stepped in and said, great, we're going to leapfrog forward. And we're going to give our populace these machines to make sure it's uptake. And that was That was the benefit. The benefit of having the government involved was you jump-started this thing and leaped in front of everyone else. The problem was it didn't adapt very well because it was government-backed and run. And there was some weird stuff about, like, I didn't quite understand, but you had to technically be a newspaper to start a service, and then you could start services to other people, and people started starting newspapers just so they could start Minitel services. And there were confusing regulations, put it that way. And that may be one of the reasons that it eventually dwindled rather than you know, turning into the web or turning into an internet. Well,
I think it served its purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, it was more, yes, there were regulations as there always are in France, and I'm sure in many countries, but I think it really served its purpose. It was what the time needed to be at that point. And it opened a lot of people's eyes and understandings to what online computer services could be. And I think the internet gained ground really quickly in France. I mean, it gained ground quickly everywhere, but there were a lot of people interested in the internet, partly because of this. I remember, it was because of university, but I often tell you that I first started getting into the internet in 93, and I couldn't wait until I would get it at home, and it developed pretty quickly in the early 90s, which might have been the case in the U.S. because that's where it originated, but I'm not sure it was as quick to develop in other European countries, for example.
And I think there's something instructive when looking at Indian, particularly African countries, who are dealing with that leapfrog situation of their own, not having the widespread landline, both internet and telephony, and jumping to smartphones. You know, there may be the next Minitel may be happening right now in those countries.
Listen, I'm sure we have a lot of Minitels left somewhere in a warehouse. Let's just send them to Africa and those countries that need the technology, and they'll be happy.
Bunch of Raspberry Pis and a Minitel. Here, go.
We're going to give you a bunch of terminals that are about as powerful as one app on your smartphone.
not even at all. But there's a lot of fun imagery of the Minitel. And there's even a project that I found out about looking for details for this episode. And it's a school that managed to retrofit the Minitel to surf the web, to actually serve the actual web. Now, of course, you know, it's they're cheating. They're using a Raspberry Pi to do the actual computing, but they're using the screen and the
screen and the keyboard,
like the old school screen and the keyboard.
It wasn't a QWERTY keyboard either, was it?
Oh well, it was a weird keyboard. I mean, it was AZERTY, which is what we use in France, but it was weird. It had like all kind of special keys, and it was a weird stuff. There were to make it simple and usable, there were kind of function keys, like five of them that did one thing, and then you had the key. It was like to try and do special functions for the inevitable hidden functions that people would develop on the chat rooms and these kind of things. It was like you had secret strings, and it was a fun time.
Well, thanks to everybody who participates in our subreddit. It's where we get a lot of our ideas about what to talk about. Submit stories and vote on them. You might be the next Minitel story submission at dailytechnewsshow.reddit.com. And, of course, on our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/dailytechnewsshow. Real quick before we're out of here, I want to read this email from Scott in the high desert, who said, I've been wondering about using electric vehicles to load balance for a while. I've also been interested in using them in lieu of generators during power outages. I moved to an old farmhouse last fall, which the previous owner had wired for a backup generator. Out in the country, electricity seems much more important. My well pump doesn't work without it. This past winter was the first I've ever been extremely concerned about power outages affecting our heat and water availability. Having an electric vehicle that I could use as a backup power for my home in a pinch would be another selling point. I also began thinking a PTO generator for our small tractor would be useful, but a small electric tractor that could be used to balance electricity would be even better. In my case, it's parked 98% of the time. Weight is actually helpful. And when using a loader, And it could double as a drivable generator if I needed to operate an electric saw or other tools while out working away from a wired power source. I also think about the maintenance a tractor requires, checking fluids, worrying about pressure and heat, etc. Below are a couple links to John Deere's electric tractor and a review of an electric riding mower. Maintenance is so much less on these devices. Oil the wheel bearings, but I think the blades are run by motors. No belt, no topping off or changing my lawnmower oil or filling gas. I look forward to the electric revolution. We'll have those links in the show notes at dailytechnewsshow.com. But yeah, kind of hits home that idea of using an electric car as a backup generator, right there, Patrick?
Listen, we just mentioned the fact a few minutes ago that I was in the country house right now, and I'm starting to worry about these kinds of things as well. You don't worry about them when you're living in the city, but when you have one power line and it can go out, and it actually does sometimes, and you have to work from this country house, you're worried about these things. It would make it, I mean, electric vehicles are still very expensive, so I think it wouldn't push people to those purchases just for that, because it's still way too expensive. But if you have more of a financial incentive to do it because of your work, or they're cheaper, yes, I want that kind of thing to be possible.
Listen, if you need to tell your wife that we decided on DTNS that it would be best for you to buy a Tesla, then you know, you can cite this email as your reason for that.
You know, the Model 3 is looking pretty sexy right now.
It's necessary. It could save your lives.
If I can invoice 2/3 of it to DTNS, let's say, or 3/4. Maybe that's doable.
I think we might need a milestone for that.
Well, let's think about it.
All right. Thank you, Patrick Beja, as always. Of course, you can find all the great stuff Patrick does at frenchspin.com or frenchspin.fr, depending on which language you want to listen to it in. What you got going on there these days?
I'll talk about the latest special we did on the Phileas Club. We had Mayank on, and he's from India, and he talked about India for about an hour and a little bit, and telling us how it was for him growing up in India in the 80s, and how India changed over the 80s, 90s, and even more recently. That was a super interesting one. So if you like that kind of discussion, then head over to frenchspin.com and listen to the latest episode of the Phileas Club.
I highly recommend it. Also want to thank everybody who supports this show directly. If you are a patron at any level, there is a specific RSS feed that includes the full pre and post show as an audio file, not just the main show. For instance, on the pre-show today, Patrick was asking us about mesh networks. So Roger and I were discussing mesh networks with Patrick for a good little while. And if you're interested in that, go check that out. If you're not a patron yet and you'd like to get stuff like that, be sure to go to patreon.com/DTNS. You only have to give $1 a month. That's the minimum. That's like 5 cents a show. So if the show is worth 5 cents to you, head to patreon.com/DTNS. Our email address is feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com. We're live Monday through Friday, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC at alphageekradio.com and diamondclub.tv. Our website is dailytechnewsshow.com, and we'll be back tomorrow with Mr. Scott Johnson. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Good show. What should we call it?
Yeah, it was fun.
That was good.
You're incompetent.
Wait, which, what?
Are you just saying that like you normally do, or is that a title suggestion?
Pick your pick. No, that's the it's one of the top
Internet of Bricks is pretty funny.
Internet of Bricks. Ow, that's a bricked. Battle.net is dead. Long live battle.net. Sorry, my neighbor's mowing their lawn. Brick to unlock. EI Uber. Something in French.
Just sweeten the print.
Future sucks. My smart house is bricked. Lockbook. Patrick Minitel's all. Ha ha ha.
Ah, nice.
Minitel me about it. I like DTNS buys Patrick a Tesla. Tom's LinkedIn theory.
Wait a minute. Tell me about it.
I think Dark Redeemer has it.
That one definitely got you. I could tell.
That doesn't happen often. You didn't tell me about it.
The temporary title, I usually just put with whoever's on. This time I put Patrick Minna Tells Us a Story.
Oh, well, great minds.
Gosh, my neighbors had electric leaf blowers and lawnmowers.
I don't know. There's a thing about, like, for me, it sounds very like I could hear a New Jersey accent or something about tell me about it. And with Minna,
tell me about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. Any others in there, Roger, that caught your eye? I kind of think we've decided, but
I think for me, that was a pretty good one. Especially since it ties in with the main discussion.
Pensieve is pensive.
Oh, there's one from Ken who says, I shall call it Minitel.
That's good, too.
Wow, that's really...
You're really into the Minitel puns today.
Listen, it's evocative of
Austin Powers.
Yeah. So, and that's always...
Well, okay, all right.
I can see... what's his face? Oh,
Mike Myers.
Mike Myers.
No, but like the evil Dr.
Oh,
evil.
Right, the character. Evil. Yeah.
I should call him
Minitel.
It's the evil phone company.
Yeah.
Looking at it, saying, "Yeah." What was Telex? Minitel was different than Telex, right?
Yes. Yeah. Telex. Okay. Oh, you didn't have Telex?
No, we didn't. I mean, I think had a version of it, but.
So basically, Telex was popular around Europe, I'm pretty sure. It was a typewriter connected to another. It was like faxes, except for typewriters.
Yeah.
So you would connect to one another, and what you would type would be transmitted to the other one.
Right. So you couldn't like copy an image, but whatever you typed showed up on the other end.
Whatever.
Right. It was basically chat, one-to-one chat. Gotcha. It was SMS, but with typewriters.
Well, because the first time I ran into Telex was 1996 when I visited London for the first time, and the hotel we stayed at had a Telex thing on its business card, and I'm like, what the hell is that?
No, I think by that time, though, in the U.S., I remember my mom seeing one in my mom's at the Wells Fargo bank, but that's like back when banks had to deal with international thing.
It was definitely a specialty thing in the U.S. It was not something you had at hotels.
Well, the fax came so quickly. And it did such a good job at having people not having to type, right? You just handwrite a note.
I mean, honestly, the telex was kind of dumb. It was kind of stupid.
It feels like a Harry Potter thing now. Like you type on one end, and then the typewriter on the other end types the same.
I mean,
I think there might have been around
forever, though. It was kind of an outgrowth of the telegraph, right? If you could just send Morse code, why couldn't you send a keystroke?
Right. Yeah.
I think there might have been ways of storing, like sending an entire string or like a page, even somehow recording it. I don't remember. We had one at home for Dad's work.
Oh, no kidding! Wow.
Yeah.
Fancy.
But I don't remember, because if it's just typing real time, then you can just pick up the phone. I mean, come on.
So is it Mini? Tell me about it. Is that what we're sticking
with? Yes.
Okay. I'm finalizing that now. So.
Tell me
a story, Patrick.
So it's the story of a little ant that goes up against an elephant.
That's a big version of an ant, right? An elephant?
No.
Or is it like an elephant that's an ant?
Why are you trying to ruin the story, Tom?
Shut up and let me tell the story.
No, now I won't. There you go.
Tell me the story. This does mean, yes, Zoe Brings Bacon asks, does this mean DTNS won't buy Patrick a Tesla? That is correct.
What?
I'm sorry, but we will not be buying Patrick a Tesla. Yet.
Right.
Never say never.
Thank you for that.
I mean, if the Patreon goes to $1 million a month, we'll see.
Or, listen. if it goes to 100,000 a month, I think you can afford one Tesla.
Can afford the payments. Well, but then if you want it, then Justin's going to want one. Then Scott's going to want one. Then Veronica's going to want another one.
We won't tell them. We won't tell them. They don't listen to the Patreon feed anyway. They won't know.
But they're going to find out because they're going to see all your Instagrams of you and your hot new Tesla.
Oh, I'll just pretend I bought it myself.
Social media blackout. TextJeb says, up until the early 90s, police departments communicated through teletype, which is a telex kind of.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, it sounds like telex.
Yeah. TextJeb also accidentally Rickrolled me on the Amazon Echo yesterday.
What?
Which was hilarious. He meant to send it to somebody else, and we are connected. And so I all of a sudden I get a message on my Echo, and I'm like, oh, play the message. And the Amazon Echo voice starts to say, "You're no stranger to love."
Nice.
Made me laugh. It's the best Rickroll I've had in a long time. Isn't it funny that Rickroll's still kind of a thing that's kind of just worked its way into our extended culture?
Yeah. It feels like it can never really go away. Like some people will not really understand it at some point, but you can go and
like cool.
It will become cool at some point.
Like the word cool was like jargon that was made up in the 60s, I want to say, maybe 50s.
Is it that recent?
Yeah. And then it didn't go away. Lots of other things like groovy did go away.
Tubular.
Yeah, and tubular. I feel like Rickroll has cemented itself.
It describes a certain type of joke, like or prank, almost a practical internet like age practical joke. So you can use it for a lot of things.
And it's harmless, right? There's nothing bad about that Rick Astley song. I mean, you could say it's not a great song. It's a bad song, but there's nothing harmful, I should say, about the song. It's just funny.
Yeah. It's kind of harmful to
to your ears. You're no stranger to love. You know the rules.
So no, I'm not. Yeah.
That's so hot fish. Dark Redeemer says we should replace cool with hot fish. Because Dark Redeemer watched Rick and Morty on Adult Swim, is my guess, because that's where I saw that.
I don't watch Rick and Morty, much to the chagrin of many internet people.
Ah, you Philistine.
It's a good show.
I watched one, and I think all the puking put me off. Does he puke all the time? No, not all the time.
Yeah. Most of the time, but not all the time.
He's probably above average in the number of times.
Above average puking.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is that a sensitive point for you?
No, but it felt like gross, like not in a good way. It felt like, I don't know, not just the puking, like the whole thing felt like
juvenile, just a lot of gross humor.
I don't necessarily have a problem with juvenile. I don't think for some reason didn't.
As long as it's mature reason. Juvenile.
I prefer refined.
Prefer a very adult, mature, refined juvenile. Like Le Stooges Trois.
Yeah, the Three Stooges.
Three Stooges.
Oh,
you know that French.
So that I don't know at all.
I never liked the Three Stooges growing up. I developed a better appreciation for them later, but it's not my type of humor. Yeah. Not a slapstick fan.
No, I did like Abbott and Costello though.
Oh yeah, I did. I liked them.
No but I wasn't a fan of Laurel and Hardy.
I like them all right. I preferred Abbott and Costello, though.
I think it's because Abbott and Costello did more wordplay, and Laurel and Hardy was a little more slapstick.
Yep. Do you like slapstick, Patrick?
Not really. I
think that's part of the issue here.
But is Rick and Morty slapstick? Really?
It's got elements of slapstick to it.
Yeah, but it's not.
I wouldn't call it slapstick, but
I'd call it funny.
I assume you love Jerry Lewis.
Obviously. Am I French? Is the answer to that question yes? So clearly.
I mean, if you were German, I would assume you love David Hasselhoff in the same way. So.
Well, interesting.
That's generational, though. Hasselhoff.
What's that?
Being German and liking David Hasselhoff is very generational.
But I think Patrick just admitted to being German.
No, I admitted to liking David Hasselhoff.
That makes you German.
You like him because he was a knight.
The law.
Knight Rider. But no, I think Germans loving David Hasselhoff doesn't mean you're German if you love David Hasselhoff.
If you like Jerry Lewis, you're French. It's the law.
No.
That is the law. That is, as I understand it, the law of citizenship.
Really? No, I mean,
Americans have a French.
You don't think any Americans love Jerry Lewis?
If they do, they're French. They're dual citizens.
All right. Well, now you're making sense.
Did you hear about the guy who is New Zealand? He's a New Zealander because the New Zealand laws say that if one of your parents is a native New Zealander, that makes you a New Zealander. And the Australian laws say you can't be a member of the Senate if you are a citizen of a country outside of Australia. And so through no fault of his own, now he's caught up into this controversy. He's not a very likable guy, I just want to say. But he didn't choose to have his dad be New Zealander.
Well, I mean, the thing to understand with that is it's been going on for like a month.
No, I know. But it is a kind of a hilarious situation where it's like, really? Like, if your dad's from another country or your mom in Australia, you can't be in the Senate. It's the way
No, you can't be a dual citizen. And
I'm sure he could renounce his citizenship.
He would.
Well, he didn't because he didn't realize
he didn't know. Had it. Yeah.
Right. But at some point he could, like now, renounce it and then.
But yeah. He was already
elected. So many things have gone in since then. The two Green senators.
Yeah.
I think had to go because one of them was Canadian, had Canadian citizenship, and the other one had.
But didn't she have, like, avowedly got Canadian citizenship? It wasn't this accidental thing, right?
No, she was just born there. Her parents, she was
born okay.
in Canada, but her parents are Australian.
So it was the same thing where she never renounced her citizenship?
Yeah, well, it's like here.
Well, that's like Mitt Romney being Mexican.
Yeah, or it's like Ted Cruz being Canadian.
Right? Yeah,
because
yeah.
he was born there. Very few, it's kind of interesting. Once you think about it, there are very few countries.
Wait, Mexican or Brazilian? I don't know. I remember.
No, I think he was Mexican, but
born in Mexico.
Like most countries in the Western Hemisphere have some sort of birthright citizenship where if you're born in the country, you're automatically.
Well, citizen. I know there's countries that say if your parent was born in this country, you can apply and get a passport.
Well,
but it doesn't automatically grant you the citizenship in those cases. Whereas New Zealand is like, France no, you're a citizen.
I think in France until very recently, like 5 or 10 years ago, that was the case as well. If you were either born in the country or, I think maybe if your parents are, you get it anyway, whether or not you're.
But there's a difference between being able to get it and having it thrust upon you. Yeah. So you're saying it was that. It was the same thing.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I think so. Mm-hmm. And it was protective for the citizens.
I was born down in a dead man's town.
Where are you
first now? Kick I took was before I hit the ground because I was born in the USA.
Very interesting, that song.
Yeah, it's actually not what you think when you
exactly hear the song. And it's being used as you think. All right, I'm gonna go.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Published now too. Thank you everybody for watching. Have a lovely day. And you patrons, go rewind and listen to the... Well, you already heard it. Never mind. Bye.
Bye. Bye.